From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, poll chaplains, a term most of us are likely to be unfamiliar with, a growing number of faith leaders are training to take up posts and polling places to provide a nonpartisan, non-denominational ministry of presence to ensure conflicts are de-escalated and voters potentially standing in hours-long lines are cared for. Meanwhile, I hope you don't subject yourself to the slanted screeds emanating from the multimillion-dollar hate group Family Research Council. But if you had, you wouldn't be surprised to see that their relentless mailings have become verbatim regurgitations of Trump re-election campaign talking points. This week, the council's political action arm ham-fistedly distributed its presidential voting guide, which is accompanied by a long list of Trump administration accomplishments and linking to the FRC prayer guide. Yes, it sure does feel like their religious and political freedom of speech is under threat, as leader Tony Perkins endlessly whines. And disgraced authoritarian political religious right hero Jerry Falwell Jr. must think enough time has already passed since his humiliating sex and alcohol scandal, a whole 2 months have passed after all, and is now suing Liberty University for damaging his reputation. Huh. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Joe Biden is unabashedly pro-abortion. He and they support abortion for any reason or for no reason, right up to and even beyond the moment of birth.
How did we start by serving a man who hung naked on a cross, but ended up serving Donald Trump?
The Democratic Party has become the party of death, and Catholic Joe Biden is their standard bearer. Joe Biden opposes the church's teaching on the sanctity of marriage.
I've heard lots of Christians say that they can't speak out against Trump because they say an attack on authority anywhere is an attack on authority everywhere. And I just have to say that that's whacked theology.
A Biden presidency would be a danger to our already dwindling religious liberty.
This president is using us, and he's playing on our tribal fears in order to stay in power.
Joe Biden is on the record as saying that as president, he would not hesitate to reinstitute a nationwide pandemic lockdown if the science demands it. Undoubtedly, such a lockdown would once again close our churches.
Christians cannot be complicit in what this president is doing.
Remarkably, over 75 million of us have already voted, anticipating a chaotic election day on Tuesday and alert to the obstacles standing in the way of votes being counted. Americans have stepped up in unprecedented ways to exercise their franchise. For an expert look at this unprecedented campaign season, I'm looking forward to speaking with political management expert Greg Lobel.
A brief summary of what have we been doing? Well, we've been on the virtual highway for 30 days. We've held 63 events, 5 rallies, 28 town halls, 25 site visits, and 5 dialogues across geographic divides.
Unable to take to the road due to the ongoing COVID crisis, the nuns on the bus took their campaign online this year with a virtual tour consisting of over 60 events in recent weeks. Nuns on the Net, if you will. A treasure trove of material from the tour is available online, and we'll hear about the highlights from the original nun on the bus, Sister Simone Campbell, on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
I, Amy Coney Barrett, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support.
This is a momentous day for America, for the United States Constitution, and for the fair and impartial rule of law. It is highly fitting that Justice Barrett fills the seat of a true pioneer for women, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Months of irresponsible rhetoric at the highest levels of our government have had a predictable effect, softening the ground for widespread doubt about the outcome of the 2020 presidential election, never mind the record-breaking voter turnout. A lot of experts are warning that a hastily thrown together Supreme Court could be the one deciding the outcome instead. Joining me now with the chilling details is author and attorney Jay Michelson, who's been relentlessly covering this threat for the Daily Beast. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton.
So she's in. The contrast between the Garland and Barrett nominations is nothing short of Shakespeareism. The Republican majority on the Senate Judiciary Committee only confirmed the character of its members by tweeting news of the confirmation with the juvenile comment, "Happy birthday, Hillary Clinton." Jay, who is running our country?
Start with an easy question. Well, we'll see. I think obviously this was a true low point. It was a foregone conclusion, so I, for one, am happy that it's concluded. I'm tired about writing about a sham confirmation process, which, as you noted, I did many times. You know, it'll be an interesting question, who's really in charge as this election unfolds. I think, you know, the most we can hope for at this point is that the margin is greater than the margin of error and the margin of dispute. There certainly are scenarios in which who's running the country will be decided by the Supreme Court if the election is close.
Was there anything more you imagine the Senate Democrats could have done?
No, I'm on the left, maybe a contrarian on the subject. You know, it's very easy to bash the Democrats and say they should have done more, or should have done this, or should have done that. The reality is they just didn't have the tools. They didn't have the tools and didn't have the votes. If you were following the hearings, they said all the right things. They expressed outrage. They said this isn't normal. They did a few things to kind of hijack the hearings and turn them to their advantage, making this a referendum on the Affordable Care Act, for example, or in Senator Whitehouse's case, talking about the dark money behind Justice Barrett. But they just didn't have the votes or the procedural tools. So, you know, it's hard to see what else they could have done that they didn't do. I mean, if people are unsatisfied with this result, they need to vote for different senators next week.
It turns out that so much of our election and governing procedures are organized around norms and conventions rather than laws and enforceable regulations. More and more, I get the feeling that the founders simply lacked the imagination to prepare us for the level of anti-democratic, scorched earth politics that has bedeviled our nation in recent years.
Well, I mean, you've made a good case against so-called originalism, which is now the dominant philosophy, judicial philosophy in the Supreme Court, which is that we should interpret the Constitution according to what the framers had in mind, or at least you know, what they what we think they had in mind when they used certain terms or when they drafted the Constitution. You know, that's a real selective reading of history. You know, the dysfunction that we see now is a result of what the founders called factionalism, which we call political parties. We also see the other dysfunction that they were aware of about having a demagogue and somebody who would take advantage of popular sentiment and some of the worst aspects of human nature. So actually, I think in a way the founders did foresee this moment. But as you pointed out, that you know, a document created when this was just a small outpost where only, you know, white male landowners were controlling, you know, power, just wasn't created for this kind of situation. Just the inequality, just to stay on the Senate for a moment, you know, the fact that the Senate majority, current Senate majority, represents something like 15 million fewer people than the Senate minority, right? Because the founders never anticipated a differential in size between states that we have today. No, there was no, you know, order of magnitude difference between the different states in the, at the founding, whereas there now is between, let's say, California and North Dakota, for example. So the idea that a minority of people would be controlling a majority of the Senate, minority of people voted for a majority for the president who's now in office, and the minority of people, obviously by transitive property, doesn't, you know, supports only a minority supports the current Supreme Court majority. So all three branches are being ruled by the minority. And that is a true failure of our system.
When people say the Chief Justice is the only one that can save us at this point, what are they thinking about?
They're thinking about 2019. You know, when he was the swing vote. And that's not true anymore. This is a 6-3 majority. This is not a 5-4 conservative majority anymore. So let's get into the weeds for a moment, because I know listeners like to do that on the election. So in the last week, there have been three cases that have gone through the Supreme Court on election rules, all on the same question about the deadline for receiving mail-in ballots. Everyone has a deadline. The postmark deadline, obviously, is Tuesday, the election day. But 18 states allow ballots that are postmarked on Tuesday but received in the next in the following couple of days to be counted. In Pennsylvania and now in North Carolina, the Supreme Court has allowed that slightly later deadline. But in Wisconsin, they struck it down. So I actually think all three cases were correctly decided. But what's troubling, and just coming to your question on the composition of the court, is four justices have now signed opinions that are really pretty dramatic in terms of what they believe the Supreme Court should be doing in the case of the election. Let's just leave it at that they're very dramatic and shocking statements that four justices have signed. Justice Barrett hasn't participated in those cases. If she's aligned with those four hard conservatives, that's five justices who say that the court should basically throw out state election returns for any number of different reasons. And again, we could get into those details. That's very surprising. So no, Chief Justice Roberts cannot save us because he's not the fifth vote anymore. Even if he votes with the three liberal members of the court, that's 5-4 against. So no, I have to look to one of the other justices. Maybe it's Justice Barrett who can save us or Justice Kavanaugh. And, you know, if you like those odds, I got a bridge to sell you.
Do you see her as someone eager to get into that?
I think it's in giving, you know, trying to be fair to her, it's hard to say. You know, she has not ruled on these questions on election law. I will say, if you look just at her record, so we don't need to do innuendo about, you know, it says in the Republican Party platform, she's there to overturn Obamacare and abortion. Trump said she's, you know, he's putting her in there so that she can, quote, do the right thing on the election, which we all know what he means by that. Even if we set those aside, if we just look at her record, as I did, I went through every single case that she voted on as a federal judge, which isn't that many. She's been there for 2 years. There is not a single time where she took the substantively liberal side. And what I mean by substantively liberal is a lot like, let's say, where Chief Justice Roberts, quote unquote, saved Obamacare, but he did it for conservative reasons. But that was a substantively liberal result, right? So there's a jurist who is conservative, has a very conservative record. Once in a while, that those conservative principles lead to a liberal political result. And that's how judging is supposed to work. That never happened. In dozens of cases where Judge Barrett, was adjudicating cases, there wasn't a single one where she happened to come down on the left side of the political dispute. So whether it was about immigration or crime or discrimination, she has a perfect record. So I want to give her the benefit of the doubt, and I do. She is now a Supreme Court justice, and she deserves the benefit of the doubt. But her record is 100% voting for substantive conservative results, and that is very troubling.
Looking at the court as a whole makes me feel like expert manipulation of a process that's overseen by a compliant judiciary. Is that too strong a statement?
No, I think that's a little too weak of a statement. I think actually this is a Supreme Court that's been stacked. As we know, it's been stacked by dark money and by religious extremists who have a very particular view of what America should look like, that it should be grounded in sort of natural law principles of biblical morality. And that coexists with a very right-wing view on executive power and on election and finance-related issues and business issues. So it's not that the judiciary is being compliant. The judiciary is being activist. If you read Justice Kavanaugh's opinion in one of the election cases, it's one of the most activist things a justice has ever said. He twisted Supreme Court precedent to basically say that the Supreme Court should get involved in any election dispute, even if it's purely about state law. So it's not a compliant judiciary. It's an activist judiciary. And I go back to what I said before. Really, the only hope for stability next week is that the margins are large enough that these kinds of questions, absentee ballots and so forth, don't matter. Because if they do matter, if we look at the record of the court, it certainly tilts in one direction to the right.
Well, I guess that makes me feel all right about being as cynical as I've been looking at things.
No, you're not cynical enough, Reverend.
So is there another perspective to consider anywhere being put into the discussion?
You know, look, I'll go back to my assessment of these three election cases on the absentee ballots. I do think all three were rightly decided, including the one in Wisconsin, which did not approve of the later deadline. That was because, you know, again, on sort of the detail level, it was a federal judge who had allowed the deadline to be extended over the expressed wishes of the Wisconsin state legislature rather than a state judge. And in Pennsylvania, there was a state constitutional provision that wasn't at stake in Wisconsin. So on a detail level, I actually think the court has reached the right result in the three cases that have gone before it. But, you know, what I'm mindful of is that certainly on the left, at least, we often fight the previous elections battles. Right. So I was down in Florida as a volunteer lawyer for the John Kerry campaign in 2004. And we were very focused on what happened in 2000. Right, with the hanging chads and with all of the ridiculousness that happened in Florida. It turned out 2004 had its own dynamic. It had Karl Rove having handed out a bunch of absentee ballots and ballot applications in churches and people all voting by mail. Back then, the Republican Party liked voting by mail. Now they hate it because different people are doing the voting. So, you know, we tend to be like one election behind. And I think we don't really know what the challenges are going to be next week. We know what they've been so far, and they've been kind of nibbling around the edges. But we also know that it's incredibly difficult to vote in some parts of the country, not necessarily in as many of the swing states, but certainly, you know, when there's only one or two places to vote in a city the size of Louisville, Kentucky, you know, and it's a particular population, communities of color that live in the urban centers as opposed to the suburbs. You know, that's outrageous. That is going to happen. That's already happened. And so we don't really know what the challenges are going to look like until they arise.
Okay, so let's pick that up right there. What would be your doomsday scenario in terms of Supreme Court interference in the outcome of the election?
I think it's Bush versus Gore redux. I did just say it's not going to repeat the past, so there'll probably be different legal issues. You know, if enough of the swing states are too close to call, so think about Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, then it will come down to some of these challenges. That means we won't have an election result for several days. That means, you know, obviously the president is an unstable personality who's gone increasingly unhinged, and there seems to be no floor. There's no level that he will not stoop to. Will he call for actual armed violence? You know, he told the Proud Boys to stand by. This would be the time that they'd be standing by for. You know, it's not unforeseeable that if this drags on for several days after Election Day, that the amount of unrest could become really quite significant. Then the president has emergency powers at his disposal that, given the composition of the court, they've certainly endorsed in the past. It's hard to see them standing up and saying no. And it begins to look like a real breakdown in the democratic process itself. So that's kind of one doomsday scenario. A second doomsday scenario is that it's not close, but President Trump simply refuses to step aside or commit to the orderly transfer of power. And what happens then? It's not really clear. We've never had that happen before. It's not clear what the role of the courts and the military are, honestly. So that's kind of the second doomsday scenario, is that the loser won't lose. And that's total luck. I mean, we really have no way of predicting that. Again, I think the surest thing that could happen would just be a devastating landslide that even, you know, everyone on the right acknowledges, and that it's not close. Because if it's close, it's going to be dragged out, and it's a time where folks listening to State of Belief need to head to their virtual church on Zoom and really start praying, and then get out on the streets and pray with their feet.
Do you know of either structural or strategic obstacles that could nudge these next days back toward democracy, or is it simply too late?
Again, you asked me for the doomsday scenario. I don't think that's actually the most likely scenario. Anyone who's on the left is traumatized by 2016, so we don't want to say anything about what the numbers look like, but the numbers do look pretty good. I actually am slightly optimistic that it won't be this close. We're sort of arguing over these mail-in ballots that were mailed late, but a lot of people have mailed in ballots early, right? 70 million people have already cast their vote. I mean, that's the half the entire total, not the mail-in total. That's the total, half the total from the last election. So, obviously those aren't only Biden voters, but this is a kind of level of popular participation that we've never seen in recent memory. And that should give us a lot of hope and a lot of courage. And we should feel really good about how many people are in the middle of a pandemic making sure that their votes count. So I don't think that the doomsday scenario is the most likely scenario. And it just, again, I think it's quite foreseeable or possible that the American people will speak in a very loud voice as of Tuesday night. And even if we don't have final election results on Tuesday night, that we could have poll results and election results that paint a very clear picture. We've already seen some Republicans kind of running for the hills. Ben Sasse, for example, kind of throwing Trump under the bus. If the numbers are a blue wave, more Republicans are going to do that. We'll have a sort of amazing amnesia that all of these folks from McConnell and Lindsey Graham on down marched in lockstep with Trump for 4 years. And all of a sudden, they'll be happy that we're turning a page and appealing to everybody for unity and peace and love and understanding. That will be nauseating, but that would also be a very positive result.
Other than making sure they vote, what else should listeners be committing to at this stage of the game?
So, yeah, I mean, my other career these days is I work for a meditation company called 10% Happier. And so we've launched a thing called the Election Sanity Challenge, which is free, which are tools from contemplative traditions, from meditation, to help people stay balanced, not to go to your happy place and stick your head in the sand. On the contrary, to build the kind of resilience, personal resilience, that's going to be necessary for this next period of time, really, whatever happens. And I think that's true, whether it's in my case, meditation, or whether it is prayer or whatever it is that people have as a spiritual practice or as sort of a psychological wellness practice. I'm not one of those who thinks, depending on where you live in the country, I'm not one of those who thinks that everybody should be staying home all the time. I think it's important to safely get some fresh air and get some movement and some exercise and safely find ways to connect with other folks. So these are the kinds of resources that we need to be building with the intention, just remembering our intention to show up and to be able to be able to show up. So people are really hurting. You know, I see on the meditation side of my career, we get a lot of user feedback. We get a lot of letters in. The newsletter I edit goes to almost 1 million people every week now, 975,000 people. We get a lot of feedback and people are hurting. And they're really hurting. And it makes sense. You know, if you're not hurting, you're not paying attention. So we need to have that balance between our inward face and outward face. We need to commit to showing up and not just to voting, but to staying engaged, but also do the work and take the time so that we have the resilience to be able to do that.
Dr. Jay Michelson is a rabbi, an author, a meditation teacher, an attorney who is a member of the Supreme Court LGBT bar, and a very good friend. His writing on the court and other crucial issues of our time appears in the Daily Beast and elsewhere. Jay's numerous books include his latest titled Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies. Jay, thank you for your insights, and thank you for taking the time again to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for those kind words, and thanks for having me.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Sister Simone Campbell, the original nun on the bus, and later, political management expert Greg LaBelle. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Over the years, Sister Simone Campbell, longtime executive director of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice, has been a welcome guest on this show, as well as a treasured friend for this host. A tireless activist, Simone is the organizer of the legendary Nuns on the Bus tours and a prophetic voice speaking truth to power. With the 2020 virtual Nuns on the Bus tour just ended and the news that she is ending her long term at the head of the Network Lobby, I simply had to have Sister Simone back with us on this week's show, and fortunately she could do that, though she always has made time to be with us when we ask. And so, Simone, welcome back once again to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks so much, Weldon. It's great to be with you, as always.
I literally have a dozen topics I'd love to discuss with you, but with a little luck, maybe I'll manage to keep it down to four or five. But here's the first one. How are you?
Oh, how am I? I am nervous, anxious, and fully engaged in this election and making sure that every vote gets turned out and then that we count every vote. So we've been talking about the season of voting, and then we have the season of counting and ensuring that our democracy can work. That's where my focus is these days. So highly focused right now on that project.
The virtual Nuns on the Bus tour was an ambitious attempt to take the legendary traveling sisters online. What was it like?
Well, I'll tell you, it was very strange sitting in the same chair for a month traveling the country. It was very unusual. But what we discovered was it created a whole new level of community and engagement.
especially our town halls in the evening, we found a way of successfully bringing people together, having small group breakout sessions, coming back, and learning together how to talk about being multi-issue voters. And the effectiveness of it, I think, surprised us. And then with our site visits, we had never recorded our site visits before. So many people now get to see and experience these amazing service sites. And then the third thing, we did these dialogues across geographic divides, which actually were my favorite. They came out of our work on the rural roundtables that we did last year. But these dialogues across geographic divides were state-based with urban folks and rural folks talking together about the struggles, the things that they face in their communities. And I have to say, they were the most rewarding to me, because it did feel like we began to mend some of the gaps that can exist. So that was heartening, that it is possible virtually to create community, engage in conversation, and then let people in on that very conversation. So I found it exciting in surprising ways.
And so you felt like you were able to accomplish what you wanted to accomplish.
Absolutely. Especially in terms of supporting Catholics, people not of faith, talking about being multi-issue voters. That was our dominant concern, because we really picked up and were fairly edgy, I like to say, feisty maybe, in lifting up Pope Francis's words to be multi-issue voters. That care, what does it mean to care for the unborn, and then how do we care for the born, the marginalized, the immigrant, you know, the whole long list of our concerns. And so I feel like we made some real important progress on that. So that was rewarding.
Simone, how much of the material generated during the 60-plus events is available online, and how can our listeners benefit from it after the fact?
Oh, yes. Well, we are in the – it's still up on our website. People can go to nunsonthebus2020.org, and the second – second headline down is that do-it-yourself bus trip. And so all of our recorded events and many more are up on the map of the U.S. And so we are also working at making it evergreen to ensure that these will stay up past the election. But right now they're for sure up until the election and the end of the week following. So people can go and look at it, and then we will have it up after that also, because it's really important to learn about our nation. And that's why we did the virtual tour, so that everybody could do their own tour. Everybody could ride the bus, because what we know is that if you live in one part of the U.S., you don't necessarily know about another part. And if we're going to be we the people, we've got to learn about each other in various states around the country. So I encourage your listeners to go up at nunsonthebus2020.org and see our map, listen to the videos, and enjoy being a nun on the bus.
Well, listen, you've got to excuse me, but I'm going to, I think, all through this interview today, come back to, at some points, the fact that you're going to be stepping down after 16 years. I ask you how you are today. A question that I got asked a lot is a question that I want to ask you too. What does it feel like to say I'm stepping down?
Well, I think it is kind of a strange feeling when I have a chance to think about it. It was hard at first to tell people that I was doing it, just because I treasure this role we've played, and being the leader of this great organization and making mischief together has just been such a joy. But the other piece I know is that we're ready for some new leadership, for some new imagination, for new mischief. I've helped lead this organization about as far as I can go, and now it's time for a new burst. And so while I'm both having some sense of sadness that this chapter is ending, what I do know is that there's way more for Network to do going forward. And I'm excited to see how it develops. We're almost 50 years old, so this is a really great opportunity to take the next step into faith-based leadership on policy issues.
Is there a favorite achievement or project during your tenure that you're especially proud of?
Well, the nice thing is there's a whole bunch of them, but I think there are two that leap out as headlines, and that is the Affordable Care Act and the letter that I wrote, the nun's letter, and got 58 leaders of Catholic sisters congregations around the country to sign, is credited as being critical in the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And while we need to improve the ACA, that it was passed helped over 20 million people get health care. I mean, how could I not be proud of that? And then, quite frankly, nuns on the bus. I mean, of all of the gifts of the Spirit, I was just really glad to receive that one and be able to make it a galvanizing force for people across the country. It was such a gift and continues to be that, even in virtual time. So I think those are probably my two highlights that I'd pick.
I do want to ask you your reaction to the flurry of attention a remark from Pope Francis received earlier this month. I don't think his comment about civil partnerships for same-sex couples is news to anyone who knows his teachings on human dignity and worth. Am I right about that?
Oh, absolutely. And he is quite consistent in that. And actually, he had said similar things when he was the Archbishop in Buenos Aires. And so, and I remember when he was being talked about as possibly being elected Pope, in one of the things that were raised as a question was, he had made these comments about civil unions. What do you think? Would this, you know, negate his election? Well, obviously it didn't. And that his consistent position has been the encouragement of everyone to flourish as and that God makes no mistakes. This is the thing. We get all hung up on our judgment lines, but you know, if we really believe that the divine is at work among us, well, don't we have to welcome and support people in their flourishing? It just seems to make sense to me. So I was excited that he did it, but it really wasn't new news. It was old news, but welcomed.
Well, it made me ask a question. Is there concern among more progressive Catholics that a virulent ultra-conservative strain inside the hierarchy is actively undermining the work of this prelate?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is high-level American politics, but it's more about secular politics that have infiltrated the church. For instance, our equally sacred scorecard, where we scored the two presidential candidates on what Pope Francis says are the equally sacred priorities, has gotten some real negative pushback from those who want to say only one issue matters. That's not the teaching of the Catholic Church, and quite frankly, never has been, if you go back and look at Pope John Paul II's writings. But the message has been hijacked for political purposes by one political party. And so some of our leadership within the church are more aligned with a political party than they are actually with Pope Francis's teaching from Rome. You know, Weldon, I have to say, I used to get criticized for being what they called a cafeteria Catholic, because I didn't buy into this only one issue matters to Catholics. That's not true, never has been true. But those who thought it criticized me for being a cafeteria Catholic. Well, now these very same people who are criticizing me for not being fully Catholic are the ones who are spending most of their energy criticizing the Pope. So you begin to wonder, you know, politics every place, I guess, is problematic. But in this instance, I find it really kind of shocking that they're not fully engaging the fullness of our faith, certainly not Catholic social teaching, that's for sure.
Well, I'm also sure that it didn't slow you down one bit anywhere along the way.
No, it didn't. It didn't.
I really need to make sure to highlight that even before retiring, you found the time to author your second book titled Hunger for Hope, Prophetic Communities, Contemplation, and the Common Good. In this age of information overload and never-ending stimulus, what should the word contemplation mean to laypersons, and how can it be helpful?
Oh, well, let me do the last one first. How can it be helpful? For me, life is the one of the ways I think about it. Life is like this snow globe that gets shaken up, and you've got all this, you know, all the turmoil and snow and everything swirling around. And the contemplative experience is putting the snow globe down on a bureau or a desk or a table and letting it sit and letting the all of the turbulence settle out, so that then there comes at times, not always, this clarity. A clarity about engagement in our world, a clarity about the movement of the divine, a clarity about the call of the Spirit. And quite frankly, that's how I knew it was time to say I should leave Network, was in this contemplative listening. I call it deep listening because it's really trying to listen to the movement of the Spirit, both in our world and in our individual lives, in our communities. And it's that effort at stillness, which is really unusual, kind of countercultural. But that is critical for me to live a gospel life.
Hmm. Simone, you've already said that you are looking at the future with an open mind and heart. What should I be getting ready to interview you about next?
Well, I do have a hot idea, but I don't know what's going to come of it. It might be a good idea. It might not. But I think we need to engage in more public listening, where this experience of doing our dialogues across geographic divides lifted up for me how critically important it is to listen to others in structured settings where we don't usually hear their stories. And so, I don't know, we'll see what happens. Some might happen. On the bus, your folks can look it up on as a site visit, but we were at the down on the border in McAllen, Texas, virtually, of course, and we were with the angry tías and abuelas, the angry aunts and grandmothers. These are women in McAllen who saw the horror of the Trump administration's immigration policy as people were just being dumped on the streets of McAllen. And these women just started volunteering, showing up at the bus stations, just trying to help people with whatever they needed, because the detention facilities would release kids and adults without, you know, without belts holding up their pants, without shoelaces, without all the stuff that they had confiscated from them. And these women, tías and abuelas, aunts and grandmothers, just started responding. And for me, hearing that story stirred me up to realize when we have eyes to see the troubles around us and just respond, isn't that what Jesus did in the gospel? And so, but we have to have eyes to see, and we have to be encouraged by the witness of others. So I think having some dialogue across divides, you know, this public listening could really help our nation step into being its best self and maybe help with some of the healing that sure seems like is necessary.
Hmm. Sister Simone Campbell is the longtime executive director of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice, the original nun on the bus. Earlier this month, she announced that she'll be stepping down from her leadership role at Network. Sister Simone's invaluable books are the new one we just discussed, Hunger for Hope, as well as A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. Simone, I know we haven't heard the last of you yet, and you can be sure that you haven't heard the last of us asking you to do something. It is so many times that I can remember when something happens in our nation, and I turn to our producer, Ray, and both of us at the same time say, we've got to get Simone on this week. And you always did it. Thank you for all that you do and for always making time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, well, then, isn't that the joy of community? We get to do this together. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Political management expert Greg LaBelle endured co-hosting our daily coverage of both political conventions earlier this year, and I kept my word to leave him be a while after all of that. But Election Day is almost here, and it's high time we look at what these unprecedented campaigns have wrought, as well as what might be coming next. And so, Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Good to hear from you.
In these final weeks of campaigning, including the second presidential debate, what has stood out to you in all the noise as being especially significant?
Wow. Well, first of all, how bad the campaign has been, the Trump campaign has been on figuring out what their message is. And when they seem to come up with something, how horrible the president is at sticking to that message. And this is the strangest in some ways, and in some ways maybe expected, but in some ways, this is the biggest piece of what's going on with this whole cycle. It's just amazing how bad they are at message discipline. I suppose it's not a surprise if you sort of look back at the past 3.5 years. So it's not a shock that it's going out this way, but how significant it is on how this whole thing has played out. You mentioned the debates. We go back to that first debate, and I mean, that was crazy town. And, you know, and he comes away saying, oh, everybody thought I did a great job. It's like he's trying to lose.
Mm, yeah. Is there a surprise that stands out for you?
I guess one of the surprises that really stands out is the number of people who have gone to the polls early. I mean, we're at 75 million people or something have already voted. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of. And it speaks a lot, I think, to a couple of things. It certainly speaks a lot to COVID and the impact of that on our election processes. And also, I think, to the effectiveness of the Biden campaign and Democratic campaigns in general in getting people energized and going. Because this is not how, with the very few exception of very few states, how we tend to do our elections in this country, which may never be the same again.
Yeah. You know, so much is unknown or confusing this year, including manufactured distrust in the voting process itself, states battling to implement arbitrary cutoffs for ballot counting, and charges of dishonesty on all sides. What is your guidance as to what we should keep our focus on?
My overall guidance is what we should keep our focus on is that if enough people vote, and this is absolutely key, if enough people go ahead and vote in the next 5 days or whatever it is, 3 days, whatever it is. And then also obviously on election day, that efforts to cast doubt on the results of the election become way less important, because the numbers, I think, will tell us the answer. So I think so. I guess the converse of that is one of the things that I worry about is these efforts at voter suppression and voter intimidation. We have to keep people focused on the fact that if we vote in the numbers that we could vote in, and it looks like we're heading in, that all of this nonsense becomes less significant and central to where we are once we get beyond Election Day.
Do you see Democrats having even a chance at being organized enough to withstand the likely onslaught of accusations and attacks on their candidates as well as on the process itself?
That's sort of the $64,000 question, Welton. I have every confidence that the Democratic Party and the Biden campaign have put together a massive effort to combat misinformation and confusion and lack of trust, which is, you've used that phrase a couple of times, and I think it's a critical one where we are right now in the results, so that they will be able to push back hard and effectively against these sorts of accusations. Of course, we will be watching the president of the United States in all likelihood lead that that effort, which makes it all that much more difficult. But I know that there are many thousands of people who are preparing for this, and I have faith that they will be ready to take it on. But there's no question it's going to be a challenge.
Hmm. Is there something about this election season that you have found to be inspiring and hope-giving?
I think the resiliency of voters in this country. I think the willingness of people to adjust their expectations in the context of, I mean, this election season has been like no other, at least on the Democratic side. I mean, the lack of large rallies, get-togethers, interpersonal sort of connections between the candidates and the voters. I worried early on that might have a negative impact on how voters were perceiving the Democratic ticket, and that has not been the case, from everything that we can tell. Just as I mentioned earlier, just the practice of voting early. We voted early here, and you know, I'm one of those folks who, for Election Day, was always sort of like Christmas for me. I get to go to the polls, and I get to go in, and I do the thing, and you know, and I vote, and we voted early, and obviously, you know, millions of people have done that, and I think that is inspiring and encouraging, and I think it speaks to a certain vitality to our democratic processes, that people have been willing and able to make those shifts and stay engaged and be engaged. The sheer number of people who are doing this is the other aspect that's changed drastically. As you know, 12 years ago, when we were looking out in 2008, I remember we were at this point sort of looking at the upcoming election and wondering how that was all going to play out. And at the time, I was in New Hampshire working on the coordinated Democratic campaign up there. And this year, those things are not happening, at least in the old way that they did. And the number of people, and again, in the thousands and thousands of people who have stepped up to the plate and found new ways to do the work that we have traditionally done in campaigns with voter contact and persuasion, using social media, letter writing, the millions of get out the vote letters that have been written by and through different organizations. This is all, in many ways, sort of a new era, I think, in the way we do elections. These things won't all go away when COVID does. So that's been an aspect that's been really quite something for me to observe and be part of.
Yeah. I know you worked for his campaign, but separate from that, I have to say that Mayor Pete Buttigieg is the one former candidate who has really distinguished himself in articulately advancing an agenda for our nation, and often doing it in places like Fox News, reaching out to voters who I think many other Democrats think are unreachable.
Yeah, that's well, to the first point you make, yes, I have seen that, and many people have mentioned to me how omnipresent he has been and how articulate he's been in making the argument for the Biden-Harris ticket and for what the future can be. That's definitely been part of it. And he's, you know, he's taken some flack, as you noted, from in some circles in the Democratic Party for going on Fox News. But when he goes on Fox News, he is articulate, he is clear, he is witty. And this is something that I think is intrinsic in the Pete Buttigieg candidacy. He's not just sticking to talking to preaching to the choir, as they say. If we don't take the opportunity to go out there with articulate, clear messages and make those cases to people who watch Fox News and other outlets, we shut the door to ever reaching any of those who might actually be interested in hearing a different viewpoint. What we always used to, my line always was, you know, we need to give people a chance to say yes. And that is what Pete has been doing, as well as, I think, reinforcing support in the Democratic ranks. But getting out there and giving people an opportunity to hear exactly what this Biden-Harris candidacy is all about. And he's been very, very, very good at it, and I'm very proud of him.
I'm curious about your opinions of how faith-driven leaders and activists have impacted this election season, because there's been a lot of that on both the conservative and the progressive side of things.
Yeah, and one thing I've noticed of late, if there have been a couple of well-known evangelical religious leaders, they haven't come out and said necessarily that you know, they're supporting Biden, but they have come out and said, and again, I think at some risk to their own reputations and so forth, that they simply cannot support this president for re-election in the face of so many things, kids in cages, the accusations against him personally, as well as in his policies, his complete seeming lack of concern for the victims of COVID. There is a crack in that wall now that I think, you know, we began to get glimmers of a while ago, but seems to have finally given way. And I think on the other side, we have seen religious leaders stand up to Trump from more progressive traditions and also stand up for Biden. And I think that speaks for Biden, well, of Biden. He is obviously a man of great faith, and that shows. And there's an authenticity to that I think allows and encourages religious leaders from the progressive side to speak out on behalf of this ticket. And more importantly, I think, on the issues they're addressing and we're facing.
Greg, looking back at these last few months, is there one thing you wish had happened, but it didn't happen, that might have made a difference in shoring up our democracy?
It's not a one thing, but it's a one person. We have observed a president since he mounted full force his reelection, concerting every ounce of his effort to introduce mistrust and distrust into the political process. And he has been, in some quarters, really remarkably successful at that effort, to the point that we have kidnap plots against the a state governor, that we have people planning to sort of stand around polling places armed with their weapons. This effort on the part of the president to seriously malign our democratic processes is, I think, one of the biggest dangers we face, not only as we come to November 3rd, but beyond. We have much work to do to reestablish some sort of trust in our democratic process, in our institutions. And tied to that, Weldon, I have to say, the way he's handled, and it's the same kind of approach, but the entire pandemic aspect, sort of sowing seeds of distrust and misinformation when it comes to public health. Both of those pieces together have done great damage to our respect for and trust in our institutions, well, democratic small d, and public health issues. And this has been, as I said, something that will take a long time for us to get over.
Hmm. Greg LaBelle is Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and the veteran of several presidential campaigns. He's held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance, among his numerous other credits, and he continues to be sought after commentator on matters of politics, ethics, and the common good. Greg, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's good to talk with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. My friends, before we meet again on State of Belief, straight ahead of us are hours filled with anxieties, hopes, disappointments, and behavior that will either strengthen our patriotism and democracy or weaken our citizenship and assault us with words and actions that hurt us more than help us. We are surrounded by threats of a deadly pandemic, political arguments that can inflame hate, a world that is locked down and breathing on edge. We must not let the threats around us shape the thoughts, spirit, and emotions within us. If you haven't already voted, vote responsibly. Think reasonably. Converse civilly. Act helpfully. And if you pray, or if you hope, don't hesitate to do so quietly. I am so glad that we are together. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, I always mean it, but today it seems more important than ever. You all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.